And good morning. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Welcome. It is 11:30, and it is time for the very first episode of Smart People, which is a weekly show in which we feature smart ideas and the people who help make those ideas happen. Today, we're going to be speaking with local designer Alex Grunenfelder about his project called Cube Living. If you've walked down West Georgia Street in the last couple of weeks, you may have noticed a window showcase featuring a neat stack of cube boxes, and they're measuring 1 cubic foot each. So these boxes actually represent tiny micro subdivisions of the 221A gallery, which the public could legally purchase and take home with them, or leave in the gallery space. As more people bought cubes, the price of the remaining cubes increased, and this reflects the effects of micro real estate in Vancouver. So I spoke to the artist last night at The Hive about his experiments, and you'll also hear Alex speaking about the Vancouver design nerds in this piece as well. So if you've been hearing about events that they've been happening downtown, then there'll be a little bit of explanation about that as well.
I'm Alex Grunenfelder. I am a graphic designer and also co-founder of the Vancouver Design Nerd Society and also a couple other design enterprises.
And you have a recent project called Cube Living.
Yes.
Okay, can you tell us about that project?
It's a critical design project that investigates the history of property development in Vancouver and where the current trends in real estate investment and property subdivision are going, and tries to engage people in a discussion about that.
And makes tiny cubes.
Yeah. Right. I guess I should say that it's a project to sell incredibly tiny spatial properties measuring 1 cubic foot out of the 221A Center in Chinatown in Vancouver.
And if we were to be in front of that project right now, it's an art piece, right? Installation?
It's a property development.
Okay, it's a property development. If we were in front of that right now, what would we see?
You'd see a pile of containers basically stacked from floor to ceiling. Each container is 1 cubic foot. And what we're doing is basically fulfilling the city's densification mandate by subdividing the space into these tiny 1 cubic foot units and making those available for purchase and ownership.
So let's talk a little bit more about the physical form of your project. How did that come together? Like, why now? Why here? And what does it look like?
So our sales center is at the 221A Artist Run Center in Chinatown.
Mm-hmm.
And so this particular phase of the Cube Living project is called Cube Living 221A because we're selling cubic feet of 221A.
For how much?
The prices started at $1 per cubic foot, and they're now up to $40 per cubic foot.
How did they go up?
Every time one of them gets sold, we just increase the asking price. So the idea was to basically kind of like test the market and see how high we can go and what people are actually like willing to pay, and sort of objectively determine the value of this space, right? In the same way that especially in like 2008, people would open like these condo sales centers, and then like every half hour the price would go up on the
mm-hmm.
on the units, you know.
So if I walked in on the first day of your project, I would have paid the lowest price.
Yeah
And then like, you know, a few bucks. And then if I walked in on the last day of your project, I would have paid way more.
Exactly. So, like, the early buyers have now, they've already seen, like, a 3,900% increase in the value of their property.
Interesting. And are those early buyers, are they allowed to resell?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And where is this money going?
Well, most of the money is just going to cover the costs of producing the project.
Right, the actual real estate price of renting a space in downtown Vancouver.
Yeah, and the just the hard production costs of the sales center, like producing all of the containers and producing the displays. And
So what happens if I were to walk into the sales center, as you describe it, and I said, I want to buy a cube, what would you say?
I would say, you've come to the right place. You're obviously an astute property consumer. You recognize that this is the most affordable property development in all of Vancouver, and also the most environmentally sustainable, probably in the world, because our containers are fully biodegradable. There's almost no carbon footprint in manufacturing these things.
And then would I get some sort of piece of paper that marks me as an owner of this?
Well, yeah, there's a sales contract
that
signs the property over to the buyer and also imposes a few conditions and terms of use of the property.
Oh, interesting. So I can't do whatever I want with my cube?
No. For one thing, you have to maintain the integrity of the container.
Hmm.
Basically, five walls of the container have to remain intact and joined at 90 degree angles at all times. So that the space inside your container is always 1 cubic foot.
Right.
Otherwise, you've basically lost that space, and so you'd forfeit your ownership. So that's one of the conditions. You can open it on one side, but other than that, the container has to remain intact. And the container actually isn't sold itself. As the manufacturer, I maintain ownership of the container, and I just loan it to the buyer at no cost in perpetuity.
Mm. Can I put things in the container?
The allowable uses are exhibition space, retail space, studio space, office space, workshop space, or storage space.
And what are some things that people have put in their cubes or done with their cubes once they've purchased them?
Well, I don't know yet, actually.
Oh, so people can do whatever. And can they take their cubes away, or do they...
Yeah. Under the ownership agreement, 221A will maintain the container and the space until the end of the month at no cost. And after that, the owner has to either take possession of the property or enter into a property management contract with 221A. But, so far, most of the buyers have chosen to take possession of their property right away.
And they just walk away with them?
Yep.
Yeah. But you mentioned that you still own the actual container. So do you need to take that back?
No. That's, basically, I loan that to the buyer in perpetuity.
Right, okay.
But the only thing that is actually transferred in the purchase is the space within the container.
Great. And what sort of response have you seen from people who have participated in the project?
Most people are really, really curious to talk about the project.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised. Most people seem to kind of understand it basically right away, but then there's a lot of kind of the details about it that people are curious about. And so it's actually been a great... it's been a great tool for just kind of getting into these discussions with people.
Right, yeah. Do you find that people feel more enabled to ask questions about real estate when they are participating in a real estate-like exchange?
Yeah, I think so. I think having framing the whole project as this point of purchase experience gives people an easy way to engage with it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if it was like an art exhibition... I think it's much more difficult for people to engage with that kind of thing and kind of ask questions about it. People don't necessarily know how to approach it. But when people come into a sales center, they sort of know kind of right away. There's like the person that comes in is obviously like assuming the role of the buyer. And so there's this kind of ready-made relationship that people can step into.
Right. Yeah, it's a relationship people are used to as well.
Exactly.
You know, you walk in, you see somebody there, you're going to engage in some sort of contract.
Yeah.
Everybody knows what to do.
Yeah.
Huh. And how many of these units have you sold?
We're currently 80% sold out, so we've sold 239 units.
Okay. And how do you plan to sell the rest of the units? Are you having more exhibitions of it?
Yeah, well, 221A is going to continue selling the remaining units out of their gallery space, and we may have some more sales events in the future. And we're also kind of looking at what sort of programming can we now do with this space, because it's essentially 221A space that these people have purchased. So they basically own a piece of the artist-run center's physical space.
So they literally own it now. That's a real legal contract that they've
exactly.
signed.
Wow. Yeah, and a result of that is that when buyers take possession of the property and take it out of the center, then the space of the center gets sort of propagated throughout the city. And so there's all of these little mini gallery spaces now. So we're looking at, we've got some possibilities for different kinds of programming that we might do in these spaces, but I don't want to talk about any details just yet.
Mm-hmm. But there are further plans to involve, you know, the many owners of,
exactly.
of the space now. Interesting. Does the price that you put on your cubes, does it reflect current market value in Vancouver?
Well, Andrew Yan from Bingtom Architects, he priced out the space of a cubic foot of property at $206. So Cube Living Project is quite a bargain in terms of like average Vancouver property prices.
Okay, and why are you doing this?
The general aim of the project is to open up a discussion about property ownership in Vancouver, kind of how space in the city is created and owned, and how people engage with that process. In a lot of ways, it takes processes that are happening now to their logical conclusion. The first property registered in Vancouver, as far as I know, was the Brickmaker's Claim in 1863, I think, which was registered by these three Englishmen that were kind of nicknamed the Three Greenhorn Englishmen because they were like right off the boat from Europe. And they claimed an entitlement that covered basically like all of the West End.
And before that, there had just been no claims on the properties.
Right. It was basically just crown land before then. And it was also kind of neglected territory because it was pretty... I mean, New Westminster was basically the center of commerce at that time. And there was pretty much nothing in what is now Vancouver. So it was a total like backwater. Property development was pretty late to start in Vancouver because of that. And so basically these three people could just come in, they could just stake a claim, and the only requirement was that they had to live on the property. So they basically took turns living in this like shack to fulfill this residency requirement, which is kind of interesting because way back then they actually had residency requirements, whereas now you can buy property anywhere and there's no requirement that you actually live there or even actually physically visited at any time, right?
Right. It's kind of
so it was sort of progressive in a weird way. But there was no when you look at the this claim, like the documentation for this claim is just like this kind of ridiculous piece of paper. There's like a rough outline of the peninsula of Vancouver and then these lines these sort of like survey lines just drawn in by hand with some really rough sort of coordinates of latitude and longitude, and they were actually able to claim about, I think they claimed 540 acres, which was basically like 60 acres more than they were even allowed to claim just through due to surveying errors. People basically thought that they were nuts because there was just like, it was just forest and swamp there. But then pretty quickly in the 1870s, people realized that the CPR line wasn't going to end in New Westminster, and it wasn't going to end in Port Moody. It was actually probably going to come down into the Burrard Inlet. And so then people were like, oh. And then Oppenheimer comes along, and he meets with the three Englishmen, and he says, if you give me some of your land, then I'll direct the CPR near your property. And that's basically, that was kind of the start of speculative real estate development and subdivision in Vancouver. And within 2 years, Oppenheimer was selling off his part of the parcel to other investors.
Okay. So when you say speculative real estate and subdivision, do you want to give just a quick explanation of that?
I think this is kind of getting to the root of the whole Cube project and the whole former eco-density project in Vancouver under Sam Sullivan, and this idea that you can make cities more sustainable and more useful through allowing more land development. So the rationale is that you can make property more valuable by subdividing it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like the Three Englishmen, they have like 540 acres of land. The CPR is coming, and so that land then becomes more valuable, but it's actually a lot more valuable if you split it up into smaller lots and then sell it off instead of just one investor, like, say, Oppenheimer. You can sell it off to, like, dozens of smaller investors, so you have a much larger market of people that can afford to buy in, and that in turn actually increases the aggregate value of the property in total. And that's kind of the rationale that's at play in urban densification too, from a developer's point of view, right? They take a land that maybe was worth $1 million as a lot for a single house with one owner, but then you subdivide that into 200 units through a strata development, and then you can sell each of those for $400,000, and so the property as a whole becomes a lot more valuable. And that's kind of been the history of property development. Mm-hmm. That's sort of happened repeatedly. But the last revolution in property development happened in the 1960s with the BC Strata Act that was adopted from Australia. And that's what actually allowed properties to be subdivided into these strata units that can be stacked vertically instead of just selling off like land surface, because that market had pretty much been saturated. But by dividing it into these strata units, you can sell them for slightly less, bring a lot more people into the market, and then the aggregate value of the original land area is exponentially higher. But at this point, that market has pretty much been saturated now. I mean, sales are slowing down. Lots of people can't even afford to sell anymore, so they just have to hold on to their property now. And so now, kind of logically, what we need to do is go smaller than that. And so what this project is proposing is that, well, basically you need to start subdividing into cubic feet, and then that's kind of where the whole densification process is sort of ideologically headed.
Mm-hmm.
Because the way to make the way that developers make money off of property isn't actually by building anything. It's really just through subdividing the property.
And your project is kind of playing on that idea of subdividing down to its finest point. Is that
exactly? Yeah, because I started this project with architect Mark Ashby in 2008, when the whole condo frenzy was at this like incredible pitch in Vancouver, and people just couldn't build properties fast enough. But when you look at the way that these properties are being designed and marketed, it's clear that what's being sold really is an investment vehicle, not living space.
Mm-hmm.
You can also demonstrate that if you look at kind of affordability criteria, like based on the Demographia annual housing affordability studies, Vancouver is now the second least affordable city in the world behind Hong Kong. The way they determine affordability is just dividing the median cost of housing by the median income. And so they, according to their standards, an affordable cost of housing would be 3 times your median income. And in Vancouver, we're at about 9.7 times that. And so why is it that properties here cost more than 3 times as much as what people can afford to pay,
mm-hmm.
reasonably afford to pay? Well,
you just asked yourself a very hard question. I should just let you ask all the questions and then answer them.
Well, I mean, the reason for that is that what people are buying isn't living space, right? What people are buying is actually an investment vehicle. Because, I mean, we're at a point now where people aren't even concerned about making a return on their capital. People are just concerned about actually having a place to put their money where they think they'll actually be able to get it back,
mm-hmm.
you know?
what effect is that having on the market when people do that?
Well, that's why real estate is so expensive here, because essentially the real estate industry is actually catering to a market for investment vehicles rather than the market for living space.
Hmm. And is the project at all connected with housing advocacy activism that's going on?
More from a discursive point of view.
Mm-hmm.
It's not connected with any specific housing advocacy organizations. It's really more coming out of a design and architecture point of view.
Right. Has it made you want
the project
has
itself?
Has it made you want to create larger collaborations?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I'm involved in, like I said, I'm involved in the Vancouver Designer Society, and so we've been fairly central to some larger projects dealing with affordability in Vancouver. Like, we had a big design jam leading up to the Rethink Housing competition.
Hmm.
Yeah, several winning entries came out of that design jam.
And what's a design jam?
Oh, basically a design jam is kind of a large facilitated brainstorming session that is usually completely open to the public and free. And sometimes it'll just be a totally open pitch session where anybody can come with any idea that they want to jam about and propose that to the group as a potential topic. And other times it'll be keyed to some sort of topical issue, like the Rethink Housing competition. Yeah, often we'll collaborate with different NGOs or government organizations or other groups in kind of framing the topic for these design jams.
Tell me about the Vancouver Design Nerds. It sounds like a really neat group that's doing lots of neat things.
Basically, it was started by me and a couple other designers in around 2004. Ruben Anderson, and Ismail Santos Bro. And we would just get together once in a while and talk about design issues and our projects we were working on. And then, because we all had different design backgrounds, we realized how great it is to actually get sort of these different points of view on things that we're doing and kind of ideas that we're interested in. And so we started kind of opening that up to more people. Then eventually we entered a design competition. I think it was called 21 Places for the 21st Century. This was like in 2004, I think. So we had like a little kind of informal jam about this with a whole bunch of people got together, and we were like, okay, so what could we propose for this? And we came up with this idea of the car park, which was basically like an old 1970s car that was converted into a garden. And the idea was that, take a car, cut off the top of it, fill it with dirt, and then use it as a planter that you can basically stick in a parking spot as a way of kind of reclaiming road space for urban gardening.
Oh, car park.
Yeah.
Car park.
Yeah, and that project then ended up being created, and the city sustainability group was also a supporter of it, and so we had it out at various different events, and eventually it found a permanent home at Broadway and Clark.
Oh.
But that was kind of the start, where we realized like how much fun it is and how productive it is to get like all of these people together jamming on ideas.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the jams you have planned for March?
Well, we've got a jam coming up at the Museum of Vancouver about cultural space in the city.
You probably also have a website where people can find these
do.
Things. Yeah. I wonder what that website is.
Yes, designnerds.org. We now have several different chapters around the world. We've got a chapter in Nanaimo, in Toronto, in Stockholm.
Those sound like three. It's funny, like Nanaimo, yeah. Stockholm, Toronto. You don't always hear those cities in the same
yeah.
sentence together.
Also, and we also have some sort of formative chapters in Portland and Seattle, and in Zurich.
Mm-hmm. Just to go back to your Cube Living project for a second, I'm wondering what kind of demographic you saw coming through to engage with the project. Like, who was coming through to buy these cubes?
It was pretty varied. It was a bit of a mix of, I guess, people who had heard about the project through the media or through hearing it from other people or from me, and then there was also quite a bit of just walk-by traffic.
Mm-hmm. And what were some of the questions that would come from the walk-by traffic who hadn't heard about it?
Maybe one of the common reactions was sort of a certain amount of disbelief.
Right, because I would think the walk-bys might actually take it seriously.
Yeah. Yeah. We have kind of tried to make it as serious as possible, because we're actually selling the space. Yeah, so I think that basically seeing people's first reaction usually is that it's a condo sales showroom. And because there's a construction project directly next door, people will often think that it's a sales center that's kind of associated with that development next door. But then as people sort of look at it more closely, they realize that it's not exactly for condos. So I think people are kind of confronted with this kind of an absurd extrapolation of the whole condo densification process.
Did you have some people coming in who seriously were looking to buy condo real estate?
Yeah, usually by the time people come in the door, they realize that it's not an entire condo that we're offering.
They have seen the cubes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're displayed pretty prominently.
Uh-huh. Were there any memorable moments from people walking through and seeing the cubes?
Yeah, well, there was one woman who actually runs a couple businesses on the street. She was worried that it actually was another condo development project. And so she was actually kind of relieved to find that there wasn't going to be another condo development happening on the street. I'm kind of overwhelmed with just the kind of the amount of interaction that we've had with this project so far.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't expect that we'd sell so many units and that people would become so involved with it. So
what were you expecting?
I guess I didn't really know what to expect, and I think that was part of the reason why I wanted to do it. I kind of wanted to see how people would engage with it. Lots of people have also gotten in touch about it, and so I think I'll see kind of where those conversations lead, and then also now that these spaces exist, yeah, there is the possibility for event and exhibition programming to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems to be a pretty hot topic right now that people want to see more, you know, more engagement with. So
yeah,
I'm not surprised. But well, thanks, Alex, for speaking to us on Smart People today, and we'll look forward to more work from you in the future.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm Alex Grunfelder. I am a graphic designer and also co-founder